6. It is said that the personal is political. That is not true, of course. At the core of the fight for political rights is the desire to protect ourselves, to prevent the political from intruding on our individual lives. Personal and political are interdependent, but not one and the same thing. The realm of imagination is a bridge between them, constantly refashioning one in terms of the other. Plato's philosopher king knew this, and so did the blind censor. So it was perhaps not surprising that the Islamic Republic's first task has been to blur the lines and boundaries between the personal and the political, thereby destroying both. When I'm asked about life in the Islamic Republic of Iran, I cannot separate the most personal and private aspects of our existence from the gaze of the blind censor. I think of my girls who came from very different backgrounds. Their dilemmas, regardless of their backgrounds and beliefs, were shared and stemmed from the confiscation of their most intimate moments and private aspirations by the regime. This conflict lay at the heart of the paradox created by Islamic rule. Now that the mullahs ruled the land, religion was used as an instrument of power, an ideology. It was this ideological approach to faith that differentiated those in power from millions of ordinary citizens, believers like Mahshid, Mana, and Yasi, who found the Islamic Republic their worst enemy. People like me hated the oppression, but these others had to deal with the betrayal. Yet even for them, the contradictions and inhibitions in their personal lives involved them more directly than the great matters of war and revolution. I lived in the Islamic Republic for 18 years. Yet I did not fully grasp this truth during the first years of upheaval, in the midst of the public executions and bloody demonstrations, or over the 8 years of war when the red and white sirens mixed with the sounds of rockets and bombs. It became clear to me only after the war and after Khomeini's death, the two factors that had kept the country forcibly united, preventing the discordant voices and contradictions from surfacing. Wait, you will say, discord? Contradictions? Was this not the time of hope, of reform and peace? Were we not told how Mr. Qomi's star was descending and that of Mr. Forsati was in ascension? You will remind me of the end of the previous section, where the choices for the radical revolutionaries appeared to be either to set fire to themselves or to change with the times. As for Mahshid, Nasreen and Mana, you will say, they survived. They were given a second chance. Are you not over-dramatizing a bit, you will inquire, for the narrative effect of your story? No, I am not over-dramatizing. Life in the Islamic Republic was always too explosive, too dramatic and chaotic to shape into the desired order required for a narrative effect. Times of peace often bring to the surface the extent of the damage, placing in the foreground the gaping craters where houses used to be. It is then that the muted voices, the evil spirits that had been trapped in the bottle, fly out in different directions. Mana used to say that there are two Islamic republics, the one of words and the one of reality. In the Islamic Republic of Words, the decade of the 90s began with promises of peace and reform. One morning, we had woken up to hear that the Council of Guardians, after deliberations, had chosen former President Hujjatul Islam Ali Khamenei as the successor to Ayatollah Khomeini. Before his election, Khamenei's political position was dubious. He was linked to some of the most conservative and reactionary groups within the ruling elite, but he was also known to be a patron of the arts. He had consorted with poets and had earned a severe rebuke from Khomeini for softening the tone of the fatwa against Salman Rushdie. But this same person, the new supreme leader who now held the highest religious and political title in the country, demanding the greatest respect, was a fake. He knew it. We knew it. And what was worse, his own colleagues and fellow clerics who had chosen him knew it. The media and government propaganda had omitted the fact that this man had been raised overnight to the rank of Ayatollah. Such a position had to be earned before it could be bestowed. And his elevation was a clear violation of the clerical rules and regulations. Khamenei chose to join the side of the most reactionary. It was not just his religious beliefs that guided his decision. He did it out of necessity, for political support and protection, to compensate for the lack of respect from his own peers. From a tepid liberal, he turned overnight into an irredeemable hardliner. In a moment of rare candor, Mrs. Rizwan had said, "I know these people better than you. They change their words more often than their clothes." "Islam has become a business," she went on, "like oil for Texaco. These people who deal in Islam, each one tries to package it better than the next. And we are stuck with them. You don't think they'd ever admit that we could live better without oil, do you? Can they say Islam is not needed for good government? No, but the reformers are shrewder. They will give you the oil a little cheaper and promise to make it cleaner. Our president, the powerful former Speaker of the House, Hujjatul Islam Rafsanjani, the first to earn the title of reformist, was the new hope. But he, who called himself the General of Reconstruction and was nicknamed Ayatollah Gorbachev, was notorious for financial and political corruption and for his involvement in terrorizing dissidents both at home and abroad. He did talk about some liberalization of the laws. Again, as Mana reminded us, these reforms meant that you could be a little Islamic. You could cheat around the edges, show a bit of hair from under your scarf. It was like saying you could be a little fascist, a moderate fascist or communist, I added. Or a little pregnant, Nima laughingly concluded. The result of such moderation was that Sanaz and Mitra were not afraid to wear their scarves, more daringly show a bit of hair. But the morality police also had the right to arrest them. When they reminded the police of the president's words, the revolutionary guards would immediately arrest and jail them, hurling insults against the president, his mother, and any other son of a bitch who issued such orders in the land of Islam. But the president's liberalism as would later be the case with his successor, President Khatami, stopped there. Those who took his reforms seriously paid a heavy price, sometimes with their lives, while their captors went free and unpunished. When the dissident writer Saeed Sirjani, who had the illusion of presidential support, was jailed, tortured, and finally murdered, no one came to his assistance. Another example of the constant struggle between the Islamic Republic of words and deeds, one that continues to this day. Their own interests precede everything, Mrs. Rezvan was fond of reminding me. No matter how liberal they claim to be, they never give up the Islamic facade. That's their trademark. Who would need Mr. Rafsanjani in a democratic Iran? This was a period of hope, true, but we harbor the illusion that times of hope are devoid of tensions and conflicts when, in my experience, they are the most dangerous. Hope for some means it's loss for others. When the hopeless regain some hope, those in power, the ones who had taken it away, become afraid, more protective of their endangered interests, more repressive. In many ways, these times of hope, of greater leniency, were as disquieting as before. Life had acquired the texture of fiction written by a bad writer who cannot impose order and logic on his characters as they ran amok. It was a time of peace. A time for reconstruction, for the ordinary rhyme and rhythm of life to take over again. And instead, a cacophony of voices overwhelmed us and came to supersede the somber sounds of war. The war with Iraq had ended, but the government continued its war against internal enemies, against those it considered to be representatives of cultural decadence and Western influence. Rather than weakening these enemies and eliminating them, this campaign of oppression had in some ways strengthened them. Political parties and political enemies were in jail and banned, but in the field of culture, literature, music, art and philosophy, the dominant trend was with the secular forces. The Islamic elite had failed to gain ascendancy in any of these areas. The battle over culture became more central as more radical Muslim youths, intellectuals, journalists, and academics defected to the other side. Disillusioned with the Islamic Revolution and confronted by the ideological void that followed the collapse of the Soviet Union, they had nowhere to turn but to the Western democracies they had once so vehemently opposed. Those whom the regime had tried to destroy or silence by accusing them of being Westernized could not be silenced or eliminated. They were as much a part of Iranian culture as these others, its self-appointed guardians. But what most frightened the Islamic elite was that these very elements had now become models for the increasingly disenchanted former revolutionaries, as well as for the youth, the so-called children of the revolution. Many in the Ministry of Islamic Culture and Guidance started taking sides with the writers and artists, allowing books that previously would have been deemed un-Islamic to be published. My book on Nabokov was published in 1994 with the support of some of the enlightened elements in that ministry. Experienced directors whose films had been banned after the revolution were allowed to show their work thanks to the progressive head of the Farabi Film Foundation, who would later be opposed and impeached by the reactionaries within the regime. The ministry itself became a battleground between different factions, what we would now call the hardliners and the reformists. Many former revolutionaries were reading and interpreting works of Western thinkers and philosophers and questioning their own orthodox approaches. It was a sign of hope, if an ironic one, that they were being transformed by the very ideas and systems they had once set out to destroy. Unable to decipher or understand complications or irregularities, angered by what they considered betrayals in their own ranks, the officials were forced to impose their simple formulas on fiction as they did on life. Just as they censored the colors and tones of reality to suit their black and white world, they censored any form of interiority in fiction. Ironically for them, as for their ideological opponents, works of imagination that did not carry a political message were deemed dangerous. Thus, in a writer such as Austin, for example, whether they knew it or not, they found a natural adversary. 7. You should stop blaming the Islamic Republic for all our problems, said my magician. I frowned, digging into the snow with the tip of my boots. We had woken up to a snowy, sunny morning, the best part of a Tehran winter. The smooth blanket covering the trees and piling up high on the sidewalks appeared to shine with millions of tiny suns. It was the kind of day that made you feel exhilarated and childlike, despite your protests against the pollution and the less tangible but more important complaints you carried in your heart and mind. Even as I tried to air my grievances, the pale memory of my mother's homemade cherry syrup, which she used to mix with fresh snow, rebelled against my expressions of gloom. But I was not one to give way easily. I was overburdened with thoughts of Azin's husband and Sanaz's young man. For the past 15 minutes, I had been trying to convey my girl's trials and tribulations to my magician, peppering my account with justified and unjustified accusations against the root cause of all our woes, the Islamic Republic of Iran. Her first week back after her trip, Sanaz had returned to class in a mood of becomingly restrained elation. Photographs were spread out on the glass-topped table. The family in the hotel lobby. Sanaz and a young man with dark brown hair and gentle brown eyes in jeans and a blue shirt leaning against the balustrade. The engagement party. Sanaz in a red dress, her magnificent hair caressing her bare shoulders, looking up at this personable young man in his dark suit and pale blue shirt, and he gazing into her eyes with tender affection. Or there he was, slipping an engagement ring on her finger, she looking at it wistfully. It's a shame his parents had bought the ring without consulting us, she said later. And here is the renegade aunt, and the depressed mother, and the obnoxious brother. Before she knew it, he had to return to London and she to Tehran. There was so little, Ali and I said to each other, Sanaz would tell us with some frustration. We were always surrounded by family. 2 weeks later, she was subdued throughout the class discussion. During the break, a woeful Sanaz, apologizing for taking up class time with her personal stories, her eyes brimming with tears and her right hand pushing an absent strand of hair from her forehead, announced that everything was off. The marriage was off. She had been jilted. A phone call again. He just couldn't see how he could make her happy. He was still a student. How could he support her? How long would it take before they could actually live together? It wasn't fair, he kept saying, not fair to her. He was making up all sorts of excuses. I can see his point, she said. I'd shared the same worries, but still, I wish he didn't feel he had to be so goddamn fair. He would always love her, he pleaded. What else could he say? Sanas had asked us. Bloody coward, I thought. Everyone, as a result, was being extra nice to Sanas. His family was very angry with him. He had been corrupted by the years he'd spent among the cold and unfeeling English, his mother said. They, Westerners, don't have personal feelings like we do. He'll change his mind, his father said with conviction. Just give him time. None of them had seen that perhaps their own meddling and pressure had forced him into taking a step he was not sure of. It was all so intolerable to Sanaz, all this commiseration. Even her brother had been sympathetic. There were rumors of another woman. There always are, Azin chimed in. That's men for you. No, Sanaz said in response to Mahshid's questions. She wasn't Persian, not that it mattered. Some said Swedish, others English. Of course, a foreign girl, always a catch. Who had said that? Sanaz was made even more desperate by the silent funereal way her family and friends walked around her. If only her brother would throw a tantrum, she said, forcing a smile through her tears, confiscate her car or something. Today was the first time she'd had a chance to get away from them, and already she felt better. Men are always more likable, more desirable, when they are unavailable, Mona said in a surprisingly bitter tone. After a pause, she added enigmatically, and I'm not saying this to be nice to Sanaz. Men, Nasreen said angrily. Men, echoed Azin. Yasi, who seemed to have suddenly shrunk to her normal size, sat up straight with her hands locked in her lap. Only the aunt was happy, Sanaz informed us. Thank God he saved you from your own folly, had been her first words. What do you expect? Only a fool would think it normal that a boy his age, or any age, could live alone for 5 years without having affairs. I did, Sanaz told her. Well, you were a fool. Sanaz's reaction on the whole had been calm and collected. She was almost relieved. In the back of her mind, she had always thought it couldn't work, not in this way. But the hurt remained. Why had he rejected her? Had she become too provincial for him in comparison with other girls, say a fine English girl, not coy, not afraid of staying the night? Heartbreak is heartbreak, I reasoned. Even English or American girls are jilted by their lovers. We had read some fine stories, the jilting of Granny Weatherall, remember? And then, of course, there was A Rose for Miss Emily. Sanaz later joked that she was thinking of making herself more memorable by imitating Miss Havisham, her heroine of the moment. Only she had not even bought a wedding dress, she added wistfully. How had we digressed from Sanaz's predicaments to life in the Islamic Republic? We had somehow managed to end our discussions with anecdotes about the regime, the number of clerics and high-ranking officials with green cards, the ruling elite's inferiority complex, burning the American flag on the one hand, and being obsequious to Westerners, especially American journalists, on the other. And then there was Faizeh Rafsanjani, the president's daughter, with her blue jeans and Reeboks and her bleached hair peeking out from under her chador. I had explained all this in detail to my magician, drawing for him vivid and heartrending pictures of Sanaz's heartbreak and Azin's grief. I had concluded dramatically that this regime has so penetrated our hearts and minds, insinuating itself into our homes, spying on us in our bedrooms, that it had come to shape us against our own will. How could we, under such scrutiny, separate our personal woes from the political ones? It felt good to know where to put the blame, one of the few compensations of victimhood. And suffering is another bad habit, as Bello had said in Herzog. There was a raising of the right eyebrow, followed by a quizzical, ironic look. "Tell me," he said sardonically, "how exactly does the jilting of a beautiful girl relate to the Islamic Republic? Do you mean to say that in other parts of the world, women are not abused by their husbands, that they are not jilted?" I felt too petulant and perhaps too helpless to react reasonably, although I could see the logic of his argument, so I kept my silence. "Because the regime won't leave you alone, do you intend to conspire with it and give it complete control over your life?" he continued, never one not to drive his point home. "Of course, you are right," he said a little later. "This regime has managed to such an extent to colonize our every moment that we can no longer think of our lives as separate from its existence. It's become so omnipotent that perhaps it isn't so far-fetched to hold it responsible for the success or failure of our love affairs. Let me remind you of Mr. Bello, your latest beau." He paused on the word beau for a few seconds. "Remember that sentence you were quoting from him, one of the many we have been regaled with in the past 2 weeks. Remember when he said, 'First these people murdered you, then they forced you to brood over their crimes.'" "Are you listening?" he said, bringing his quizzical eyes closer to my face. "Where have you wandered off to?" "Oh, I'm here all right," I said. "I was just thinking." "Right," he said, remembering his British training. "Really, I was listening," I said. "You've just clarified something for me, something I'd been thinking of a lot lately." He waited for me to continue. "I was thinking about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. About the fact that my girls are not happy. What I mean is that they feel doomed to be unhappy." "And how do you propose to go about making them understand that it is their right?" he asked. "Surely by not encouraging them to act like victims. They have to learn to fight for their happiness." I continued to dig my boots deeper into the snow, struggling to keep pace with him at the same time. "But so long as we fail to grasp this and keep fighting for political freedom without understanding its dependence on individual freedoms, on the fact that your sonas shouldn't have to go all the way to Turkey to be courted, we don't deserve those rights." Having listened to his lecture and not finding anything in it to contradict, I allowed myself my own train of thought. We walked for some time in silence. But don't you see that in trying to make them understand this, I might be doing these girls more harm than good, I said, perhaps rather dramatically. You know, being with me, hearing about my past experiences, they keep creating this uncritical, glowing picture of that other world, of the West. You mean you've been helping them create a parallel fantasy, he said. One that runs against the fantasy that the Islamic Republic has made of their lives. Yes, yes, I said excitedly. Well, first of all, it's not your fault. None of us can live in and survive this fantasy world. We all need to create a paradise to escape into. Besides, he said, there is something you can do about it. There is? I said eagerly, still dejected and dying for once to be told what to do. Yes, there is. And you are in fact doing it in this class, if you don't spoil it. Do what all poets do with their philosopher kings. You don't need to create a parallel fantasy of the West. Give them the best of what that other world can offer. Give them pure fiction. Give them back their imagination, he ended triumphantly, and looked at me as if he expected hurrahs and the clapping of hands for his wise advice. You know, it might do you some good if you practiced what you preached for a change. Take the example of one Jane Austen, he said, with what appeared to me a patronizing munificence. You used to preach to us all that she ignored politics, not because she didn't know any better, but because she didn't allow her work, her imagination, to be swallowed up by the society around her. At a time when the world was engulfed in the Napoleonic Wars, she created her own independent world, a world that you, 2 centuries later, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, teach as the fictional ideal of democracy. Remember all that talk of yours about how the first lesson in fighting tyranny is to do your own thing and satisfy your own conscience, he continued patiently. You keep talking about democratic spaces, about the need for personal and creative spaces. Well, go and create them, woman. Stop nagging and focusing your energy on what the Islamic Republic does or says and start focusing on your Austen. I knew he was right, although I was too frustrated and too angry with myself to admit it. Fiction was not a panacea, but it did offer us a critical way of appraising and grasping the world, not just our world, but that other world that had become the object of our desires. He was right. I was not listening. Otherwise, I would have had to admit that my girls, like millions of other citizens, by refusing to give up their right to pursue happiness, had created a dent in the Islamic Republic's stern fantasy world. When he resumed, his voice seemed to come from afar and to reach me through a fog. When you were talking of creating this secret class of yours, I thought it might be a good idea, he was saying, partly because it would divert your attention from politics. But I see it's done the opposite. It has involved you even more. When I first told him about my decision to resign from the university and to create this secret class, he had said, "How are you going to survive? You have severed your public contacts. Your teaching is your last refuge." I said I wanted to teach a class, a literature workshop at home, with only a few select students who really love literature. Will you help me? I will help you, he said, of course. But do you know what this means? What? I asked. You will be leaving as soon. You are withdrawing more and more into yourself. You have gradually resigned from all activities. Yes, but what if I have my class? Your class will be at home, he said. You used to talk about writing your next book in Persian. Now all we talk about is what you will be saying at your next conference in the US or in Europe. You are writing for other readers. I said, I have you. He said, I'm not a good example. You use me as part of your dream world. When we parted and I headed back home, my mood had already changed. I was thinking of the new novel I had lately been planning to add to our list, Saul Bellow's The Dean's December, one that dealt with the ordeals of the East and those of the West. I felt guilty about my complaints to my magician. I had so much wanted him to change everything right there and then, to rub the magic lamp and make the Revolutionary Guards vanish, along with Azin's husband and Mahshid's boss. I wanted him to put a stop to all this, and he was telling me not to get so involved. I felt ashamed of myself for refusing to understand him, for acting like a petulant child, carelessly punching a beloved parent. The sun had already started to set as I returned home. It seemed to withdraw one by one the brilliant specks it had scattered over the snow. When I got home, I felt grateful to see a fire blazing in the fireplace. Bijan looked serene in a chair drawn closer to the fire, a small glass of bootleg vodka near him on the table, reading the long goodbye. From the window, I could see the snow-covered branches and the faded outlines of the mountains, barely discernible behind the haze. 8. They tried to be very modern about it, Yossi said, with a hint of sarcasm, sprawled in her usual place on the couch. Yossi was narrating her latest adventure with a gentleman caller, Hertha. There was a great pressure on her to get married. Her best friends and closest cousins were either married or spoken for. Both his family and mine agreed that we had to get to know each other before coming to any decisions. So we go to this park, and we're supposed to become intimately acquainted by walking and talking for the next hour, she said, in the same sarcastic tone, but with an expression that suggested she was enjoying herself. She went on to say, he and I walk in front, followed by my parents, my older sister, and two of his sisters. I can almost hear them as they pretend to talk casually about all kinds of things while the two of us pretend to ignore their presence. I ask him about his field, mechanical engineering. Reading anything interesting? Doesn't have time to read. I have a feeling he wants to look at me, but he can't. When he came to my uncle's house to officially ask for my hand, he had to keep his head down the whole time. And here again, it's impossible to get a good look. So we walk side by side, our eyes glued to the ground. All the time, I'm thinking crazy thoughts, like, how would a man know that the woman he was intending to marry was not bald? That's easy, said Nasreen. In the old days, women from the man's family used to scrutinize the would-be bride, even her teeth. Yossi said, thank God I have all my teeth. Anyway, we were passing our time in this fashion until suddenly I got a brilliant idea. I started to walk faster, catching them all by surprise. As they tried to adjust to my pace, I came to a sudden halt, forcing them to almost collide into us. He was genuinely startled, but tried to hide it by adjusting to my pace. I made some futile attempts to catch his eyes. Here's what I was thinking. If he gets it and laughs, I'll give it a chance. If he doesn't, that's it. I won't waste my time. I knew every one of my uncles would have immediately joined me in the game. After this, she fell silent. Well, what happened? Oh, she said, as if she had woken from a trance. Nothing. Nothing? No, she said. The idiot didn't even ask me why I was suddenly walking faster. Out of politeness, he just tried to fall into step with me. After a while, I got tired of it. And then we said goodbye, and I didn't respond to their inquiries until they stopped asking. I'm sure he's by now happily married to a girl with less flesh on her, she said, looking at us merrily. She always loved telling a good story, even when she herself was the butt of the joke. It had been an exhausting week for Yossi, what with this new suitor and her uncle's departure for the States. Every time her uncle visited Iran, and it was not often, he provoked doubts and questions in Yossi, who would be plagued for weeks with vague and uneasy longings that made her yearn without exactly knowing what for. She knew now that she must go to America, as she had known when she was 12 that she must play the forbidden musical instrument. Her playing of the instrument, her insistence on going to university in Tehran, her choosing to come to this class, all were preparations that led her toward her final goal, to be physically where her uncles were and to get a taste of the tantalizing fruit that had always dangled over the lives of her mother and aunts, beckoning and just out of reach. They, the women, had lacked nothing in intelligence and intellect, but they had lacked freedom. Yossi had no choice but to want to be like her uncles, not necessarily like them, but to be possessed of what seemed to her their inalienable rights. I didn't want her to be married. I wanted her to go through the whole ordeal and conquer the obstacles. The odds were overwhelmingly against her. From family opposition, it was unprecedented for a girl to go abroad to study, to enormous financial difficulties. Then there was the problem of getting accepted to an American college and obtaining a visa. I wanted her to succeed not only for herself, but also for the rest of us. I always had a hankering for the security of impossible dreams. This was a day for gentleman callers. Sana's, too, was full of stories. After the failure of her engagement, Sana's went on a spree, going on dates with different suitors and giving us meticulous accounts of the American-educated engineer with a green card, a status symbol, who had picked her out in a family photograph and on arrival in Tehran had sought her out and invited her to a Swiss restaurant. The rich merchant, who loved the thought of an educated, attractive wife and wanted to buy a whole library for her so that she wouldn't leave home, and so on. These outings were a matter of binge and purge for Sana's. Learn from us, said Azin. Why do you need to be married? The flirtatious note had briefly returned to her voice, don't take these people seriously. Just go out with them to have fun. My lawyer friend was having a great deal of difficulty in trying to help Azin. At first, Azin had been adamant about wanting a divorce. 10 days later, she had come to the lawyer's office with her husband, mother-in-law, and sisters-in-law. She thought reconciliation was possible. Soon after that, she barged in without an appointment. She was all bruised, claimed that he had beaten her again and taken their little girl to his mother's house. Then at night he had knelt by her bedside, weeping and pleading with her not to leave him. When I mentioned this to Azin, she broke into tears again, saying that he would take the child away from her if she went through with the divorce. That girl was her whole life. And you know the courts, child custody always went to the father. She knew the only reason he wanted the child was to hurt her. He would never care for her. Most probably, he'd send her to his mother's. Azin had applied for a visa to Canada. But even if her application was accepted, she couldn't leave the country without her husband's permission. Only if I take my own life can I act without my husband's permission, she said, desperately and dramatically. Mana agreed with Azin, but it was difficult for her to admit it. If I were you, I'd get out of this country while I can, had been her advice to Sanaz. Don't stay here, and don't marry anyone who'll have to stay here. You'll only rot. Mahshid looked at her reproachfully. This is your country, she said, pursing her lips. There's a lot you can do. There's nothing you can do. Nothing, said Mana with a firm finality. You can write and you can teach, said Mahshid, throwing a passing glance at me. We need good critics. We need good teachers. Yes, said Mana, like Professor Nafisi. Work your head off for so many years, and then what? The other day, Nima was saying he would be making more money if he'd become a street vendor instead of spending all those years getting an MA in English Lit. If everybody leaves, said Mahshid, her eyes glued to the floor, who will help make something of this country? How can we be so irresponsible? This was a question I asked myself day and night. We can't all leave this country, Bijan had told me. This is our home. The world is a large place, my magician had said when I went to him with my woes. You can write and teach wherever you are. You will be read more and heard better, in fact, once you're over there. To go or not to go? In the long run, it's all very personal, my magician reasoned. I always admired your former colleague's honesty, he said. Which former colleague? Dr. A, the one who said his only reason for leaving was because he liked to drink beer freely. I'm getting sick of people who cloak their personal flaws and desires in the guise of patriotic fervor. They stay because they have no means of living anywhere else, because if they leave, they won't be the big shots they are over here. But they talk about sacrifice for the homeland. And then those who do leave claim they have gone in order to criticize and expose the regime. Why all these justifications? He had a point, but things were not that simple. I knew Bijan wanted to stay, not because he couldn't find a job or a place in the States. Most of his immediate family were there, and he himself had lived there more years than in Iran. I want to stay because I love this country, he told me. We should stay as a form of resistance to show that we are not outmaneuvered. our very presence is a thorn in their side. Where else in the world, he asked me, would a talk on Madame Bovary draw such crowds and nearly lead to a riot? We can't give up and leave. We're needed here. I love this country, he repeated. Did I not love this country? I asked myself. Bijan agrees with you, I told Mahshid. He is more rooted to the idea of home. He created this home, literally, building our apartment and our place in the mountains, and established routines like watching the BBC and cooking barbecues for friends. It's much harder to dismantle that world and to rebuild it somewhere else. I guess the point is, we all have to make our own choices according to our potentials and limitations, I said. And as I was saying it, I knew how superficial my words must have sounded to them. I have the best excuse for going to America, said a cheeky Yossi. It's because I'm so plump. Fat girls, I'm told, have a much better time over there. They say Americans like them with a little meat on their bones. It depends on the girl, Mitra offered with a slight jab at Yossi. Mitra, of course, would have no problem anywhere on earth with her dimples and large brown eyes. She and Hamid had decided to head to Syria for a week to interview for Canadian residency. Canada did not accept immigrant visa applications in Iran, although she still vacillated between leaving and staying. Over here, we have an identity, she said doubtfully. We can make something of our lives. Over there, life is unknown. The ordeal of freedom, Nasreen said elliptically, echoing my favorite line from Bellow. Only Mahshid was silent. She, I knew, was more confident than the rest about what she wanted. She didn't want to marry. Despite all her traditional beliefs and moral imperatives, Mahshid was less of a marrying type than Sanaz. She disapproved of the regime, but her problems were more practical than existential. Long disappointed about the prospects of marrying her ideal man, and utterly without illusions about her ability to survive abroad, she had set her whole heart and mind on her work. At the moment, her problem was how to surmount the stupidity and ignorance of her bosses, who rewarded her exceptional work with something akin to envy and held her political past over her head like a sword. I worried about Mahshid and the solitary path she had chosen for herself, and about Yossi and her irrepressible fantasies about that never-never land where her uncles lived. I worried about Sanaz and her broken heart, and about Nasreen and her memories, and about Azin. I worried about them all, but I worried most about Mana. She had one of these honest, demanding intelligences that is hardest on itself. Everything in her present situation offended her, from the fact that she and her husband were still financially dependent on her family to the mediocre state of intellectuals and the everyday cruelties of the Islamic regime. Nima, sharing the same feelings and desires, reinforced her imposed isolation. Yet unlike Yossi, Mana obstinately refused to do anything about her situation. She seemed to take an almost gleeful satisfaction from the knowledge that her powers were going to waste. She, like my magician, was determined to be harder on herself than on the world around her. They both blamed themselves for the fact that such inferior people had control of their lives. How is it that we keep coming back to marriage? Mitra said. when we're supposed to be here to talk about books. What we need, I said with a laugh, is for Mr. Nahvi to remind us how trivial we are to read Austen and talk about marriage. Mr. Nahvi, with his dusty suit, buttoned-up shirt, layered hair, and squishy eyes, was every once in a while resurrected as an easy target of our jokes. He earned my eternal contempt the day he announced that the protagonist in Gorky's Mother was a far finer specimen of womanhood than all the flighty young ladies in Jane Austen's novels. 9. Olga was silent. "Ah," cried Vladimir, "why can't you love me as I love you?" "I love my country," she said. "So do I," he exclaimed. "And there is something I love even more strongly," Olga continued, disengaging herself from the young man's embrace. "And that is?" he queried. Olga let her limpid blue eyes rest on him and answered quickly, "It is the party." Every great book we read became a challenge to the ruling ideology. It became a potential threat and menace, not so much because of what it said, but how it said it, the attitude it took toward life and fiction. Nowhere was this challenge more apparent than in the case of Jane Austen. I had spent a great deal of time in my classes at Allame contrasting Flaubert, Austen and James to the ideological works like Gorky's Mother, Sholokhov's And Quiet Flows the Dawn, and some of the so-called realistic fiction coming out of Iran. The above passage, quoted by Nabokov in his lectures on Russian literature, caused a great deal of mirth in one of my classes at Allame. "What happens," I asked my students, "when we deny our characters the smallest speck of individuality? Who is more realized in her humanity, Emma Bovary or Olga of the limpid blue eyes?" One day, after class, Mr. Nahvi followed me to my office. He tried to tell me that Austen was not only anti-Islamic, but that she was guilty of another sin. She was a colonial writer. I was surprised to hear this from the mouth of someone who until then had mainly quoted and misquoted the Quran. He told me that Mansfield Park was a book that condoned slavery, that even in the West they had now seen the error of their ways. What confounded me was that I was almost certain Mr. Nahvi had not read Mansfield Park. It was only later, on a trip to the States, that I found out where Mr. Nahvi was getting his ideas from when I bought a copy of Edward Said's Culture and Imperialism. It was ironic that a Muslim fundamentalist should quote Said against Austen. It was just as ironic that the most reactionary elements in Iran had come to identify with and co-opt the work and theories of those considered revolutionary in the West. Mr. Nahvi kept following me to my office and spouting these pearls of wisdom. He seldom brought them up in class. There, he usually kept silent, preserving a placid and detached expression as if he had agreed to remain in class as a favor to us. Mr. Nahvi was one of the few students in whom I was unable to find a single redeeming quality. I could say, like Eliza Bennett, that he was not a sensible man. One day, after a really exhausting argument, I told him, "Mr. Nahvi, I want to remind you of something. I'm not comparing you to Elizabeth Bennet, There is nothing of her in you, to be sure. You are as different as man and mouse. But remember how she's obsessed with Darcy, constantly trying to find fault with him, almost cross-examining every new acquaintance to confirm that he is as bad as she thinks? Remember her relations with Wickham? How the basis for her sympathy is not so much her feelings for him as his antipathy for Darcy? Look at how you speak about what you call the West. You can never talk about it without giving it an adjective or an attribute. Decadent, vile, corrupt, imperial. Beware of what happened to Elizabeth. I still remember the look on his face as I said this, and for once used my privilege as his teacher to have the last word. Mr. Nahvi exercised a great deal of influence in our university, and he once reported Nasreen to the disciplinary committee. His eagle eyes had detected her running up the stairs one day when she was late for a class. Nasreen at first refused to sign a retraction stating that she would promise never again to run on the university premises even when she was late for class. She had finally conceded, persuaded by Mrs. Rezvan, who had reasoned with her that her obstinate resistance was not worth expulsion from the university. During our reminiscences about Mr. Nahvi, I noticed Mitra and Sanaz whispering and giggling. When I asked them to share with us the source of their mirth, Sanaz encouraged the blushing Mitra to tell her story. She confessed that among their friends they called Mr. Nahvi the Mr. Collins of Tabatabai University, after Jane Austen's pompous clergyman. One evening after class, Mr. Nahvi had suddenly appeared in front of Mitra. He had not seemed his usual redoubtable self, the incorrigible Yossi suggested. No, not exactly. Pontificating, pompous, ponderous, Yossi continued, unabashed. No. Anyway, Mr. Nahvi did not seem himself. His arrogance had given way to extreme nervousness as he handed Mitra an envelope. Sanaz nudged Mitra to describe the envelope. It was a hideous blue, she said, and it reeked. It reeked? Yes, it smelled of cheap perfume, of rose water. Inside the envelope, Mitra had found a one-page letter with the same dreadful color and smell, written in immaculate handwriting in black ink. "Tell him how he started the letter," Sanaz encouraged Mitra. "Well, he actually began by writing..." Mitra trailed off as if lost for words. "My golden daffodil!" shouted Sanaz, bursting into laughter. "Really? Golden daffodil?" "Yes," and he had gone on to express his undying love for Mitra, whose every move and every word were ingrained in his heart and mind. Nothing, no power, had ever done to him what her smile, which he hoped was for him and him alone, could do, and so on and so forth. What had Mitra done, we all wanted to know. All this had taken place in the middle of Mitra and Hamid's highly secretive courtship, Sanaz reminded us. The next day, when Mr. Nahvi happened to jump out of nowhere and waylay her in the street, she tried to explain to him how impossible it was for her to return his affections. He nodded philosophically and went away, only to reappear 2 days later. She had parked in an alley near the university and was in the process of opening the door to her small car when she became aware of a presence right behind her. like the shadow of death, Nasreen ominously interjected. Well, she turned to find Mr. Nahvi, wavy hair, squished eyes, ears jutting out. He had a book in his hand, a book of poems by E.E. Cummings. And the blue of another envelope could be detected from between its pages. Before Mitra had time to protest, he thrust the book into her hands and disappeared. "Tell Dr. Nafisi what he wrote," prompted Sanaz. She'd love to know that her classes were of some use to Mr. Nahvi. Inside he had written, "To my bashful Rose." "And what else?" "And well, he reproduced a poem that you used to teach in your introduction to literature class." "Somewhere I have never traveled gladly beyond any experience, your eyes have their silence. In your most frail gesture are things which enclose me, or which I cannot touch because they are too near. Your slightest look easily will enclose me. Though I have closed myself as fingers, you open always, petal by petal myself, as spring opens, touching skillfully, mysteriously, her first rose. Or if your wish be to close me, I and my life will shut very beautifully, suddenly, as when the heart of this flower imagines the snow carefully everywhere descending. Nothing which we are to perceive in this world equals the power of your intense fragility, whose texture compels me with the color of its countries, rendering death and forever with each breathing. I do not know what it is about you that closes and opens. Only something in me understands the voice of your eyes is deeper than all roses. Nobody, not even the rain, has such small hands." "It's enough to put you up teaching poetry," I said, infected by their girlish mood. "From now on, you should only teach morbid poems like Childe Harold or The Rime of the Ancient Mariner," suggested Mahshid. This time, Mitra felt she had to resort to more drastic measures before things got out of hand. After several consultations with her friends, she reached the conclusion that a plain, outright no would be dangerous to deliver to someone as influential as Mr. Nahvi. Best to tell him a convincing lie that would put him in an impossible position. By the time they next crossed paths, Mitra had plucked up the courage to stop Mr. Nahvi. Blushing and stammering, she told him that she had been too bashful to reveal the real reason for her rejection. She was engaged to be married to a distant relative. His family was influential and very traditional, and she was scared of what they would resort to if they found out about Mr. Nahvi's outpourings. The young man paused for a fraction of a second, as if rooted to the ground, and then turned away without a word, leaving Mitra still slightly trembling in the middle of the wide street. 10. The last New Year Mrs. Rezvan was in Tehran, she bought me 3 small clips. They were hair clips that many women use to keep their headscarves in place. I never learned to wear my scarf properly, and it had become a ritual between us that before talks or lectures, she would check and make sure that it was more or less in place. She said, "My dear Mrs. Nafisi, I am sorry that this is what you will remember me by, but I do worry about you. Will you promise me you will wear these when I'm gone?" I want to see you here when I return. Mrs. Rezvan was preparing to go to Canada. She had finally, after years of toil, managed to get her coveted scholarship to pursue her PhD. For years, she had dreamed of this, but now she was too anxious to enjoy the moment. She constantly fretted about whether she would succeed, whether she was up to the task. I was happy that she was leaving, both for her sake and for my own. It came almost as a relief. I felt at the time that she was overly ambitious and that she used me and people like me to get where she wanted to go. Later, I discovered there was more to the story. Hers was not a mere ambition to go places, to become president of the faculty, although she had that in mind too. She yearned to become a literary personage. Her love of literature was real, yet her talents were limited, and her ambition for power and control sometimes surpassed and even came to clash with that love. She managed to evoke such contradictory feelings in me. I felt she was always on the verge of telling me something important about herself, something that would reveal her to me. Perhaps I should have been more curious. Perhaps if I had been less wrapped up in her intrusions and demands, I would have noticed more. In the late summer of 1990, for the first time in 11 years, my family and I left for Cyprus for a vacation and to meet up with my sisters-in-law, who had never seen our children. For years, I was not allowed to leave the country, and when they finally did give me permission to leave, I felt paralyzed and could not make myself apply for a passport. If it were not for Bijan's patience and persistence, I never would have followed through. But I got my passport in the end, and we did really leave without any misadventures. We stayed with a friend, one of Miss Rezvan's former students. She said Mrs. Rezvan used to ask her about me, my work, and my family. Later, after we returned home, my friend informed me that the day we left, probably on the same plane aboard which we had flown to Tehran, Mrs. Rezvan had come to Cyprus on vacation. She was alone. She called my friend, inquiring after me, and was told that I was gone. My friend told me Mrs. Rezvan wanted her to take her to the same places we had visited together during my stay. She asked what I had done there, where I had gone. One day they went to the beach where we had gone swimming. Mrs. Rezvan was shy. She hesitated about putting on a swimsuit. And when she did, she wanted to go to a deserted part of the beach where no one could see her. She ran into the water, but came out after a short while, telling my friend that no matter how hard she tried, she could not get used to parading around in a swimsuit. When she left Iran, Mrs. Rezvan disappeared from my life. Her absence was as complete as her presence had been pervasive. She did not write or call when she came back for her occasional visits. I heard about her from the secretary at the English department. Twice she had asked for an extension in order to finish her dissertation. At times, walking down the halls or passing by her office, I was reminded of Mrs. Rezvan, whose absence was both a relief and a sorrow. A few months after I came to America, I heard she was ill with cancer. I called her. She was not home. She called me back. Her voice was filled with the intimate formality of Tehran. She wanted to know about some of our common students and my work. And then for the first time, she opened up and started talking about herself. She could not write. It involved so much pain. And she was always weak and fatigued. Her eldest daughter helped her. She had so many dreams, and she was hopeful. The openness was not so much in what she said as in her tone of voice, which conferred a certain air of confidence to her simple report of her weakness, her inability to write, her dependence on her daughter. She was optimistic about the latest treatment, although her cancer had spread far. She asked me about my work. I did not tell her that I was healthy and writing a book and, on the whole, enjoying myself. That was the last time I talked to her. She was soon too sick to speak on the telephone. I thought of her almost obsessively. It seemed so unfair that she should have cancer when she was so near to reaching her goal. I did not want to talk to her to remind her that once again I had been the lucky one. I was granted a little more time on earth, the time she was so unfairly cheated of. She died soon after our last conversation. Her intrusions now have taken a different form. In my mind, from time to time, I resurrect and recreate her. I try to penetrate the unsaid feelings and emotions that hung between us. She keeps coming towards me through the flickering light as in our first meeting, with that ironic sideways glance, and passes through me, leaving me with my doubts and regrets.